I have been trying to get a promotion at work, and I think that my boss has been blocking it. This is obviously playing on my mind, and it is time that I did something about the situation. Finding your dream solution. In the late 1970s, William Dement, a sleep researcher at Stanford University, speculated that dreams often represent a weird form of lateral thinking, in which the mind attempts to solve a problem by looking at it from several new and unusual perspectives. To find out whether he was right, Dement assembled a group of 500 volunteers and presented them with the type of puzzles that you heard at the start of this lesson. These puzzles were carefully chosen because they appear tricky at first. But then the solution becomes obvious when you view the puzzle from the correct perspective. Half of Dement's volunteers were shown the puzzles in the morning and were asked to try to solve them that evening. The other half was given the puzzles just as they went to bed, and they were asked for their answers in the morning. According to Dement's theory, the group that went to bed would outperform the daytime puzzle solvers, which is exactly what happened, with those who slept on the problem obtaining significantly higher scores. Not only that, but many of the dreams related to the puzzles. For example, the first problem involved finding the missing letters in the sequence OTTFF. One participant described how they had dreamt about wandering through an art gallery, counting the paintings. All was well, except that the sixth and seventh paintings had been ripped out of their frames. They woke up and realized that the sequence is derived from the initial letters of the words 1, 2, 3, and that the missing letters relate to the words 6 and 7. Oh, and if you haven't solved them yet, the numbers in the second puzzle are in alphabetical order. A is for 8, F is for 5 and 4, and so on. And the letters in the final puzzle are the first 9 letters of the words in the sentence, "Can you work out the next letter in this sequence?" So the next letter is S. In a follow-up study, Gregory White from the Reading Academic Center in California examined whether this effect might be due to relaxation. White asked a group of volunteers to make a list of up to 8 moderately distressing personal problems. Some of the volunteers were then asked to explore possible solutions to their problems after either dreaming or carrying out a relaxation exercise. The volunteers carried out these procedures for 10 days, recording both the degree to which they had found a solution and their level of distress. Compared to the volunteers carrying out the relaxation exercises, those who sought solutions in their dreams solved more of their problems and reported significantly lower levels of stress. Another study conducted by Denise Kai from the University of California at San Diego showed that it is dreaming rather than sleeping that helps people solve problems. In this study, a group of volunteers were presented with a series of puzzles that required creative thinking, and then asked to lie down for just over an hour. Some of the volunteers rested, while others fell asleep. Among the sleepers, some dreamt, and others didn't. At the end of the session, everyone was presented with the puzzles a second time, and the results revealed that only those who had spent some time dreaming solved more. Work by Sarah Mednick from University of California, San Diego showed that even a few minutes dreaming had a considerable impact on people's problem-solving skills. Mednick first tested volunteers' creative problem skills by presenting them with sets of 3 seemingly unrelated words: elephant, lapse, vivid, and asking them to think of a 4th word that relates to all of them: memory. The volunteers were then randomly split into 3 groups. One group sat quietly in a chair, another group took a 60-minute nap, and the 3rd group was allowed the luxury of a 90-minute snooze. Because of the 90-minute sleep cycle, only those in this 3rd group had a dream, Finally, the volunteers' creative problem-solving skills were then tested a second time. Only those who napped for 90 minutes obtained higher scores in the test. There is considerable anecdotal evidence suggesting that the same type of dream problem-solving can also help people find the solution to important issues in their lives. Take, for example, how a dream persuaded entrepreneur Callie Ellis to completely change her life. In 1990, Ellis was in a job she hated and had just broken up with her long-term boyfriend. One night, Ellis had a dream in which she saw herself running a trendy flower shop and exhibiting her beautiful bouquets and arrangements across the world. She woke up feeling a wonderful sense of happiness and knew that her dream contained an important message. Ignoring the recession and her complete lack of experience in floristry, Ellis handed in her notice and opened a small flower shop in Shoreditch, London. After 4 years of hard work, she got her first big break when she was asked to provide the flowers for a Vanity Fair event. All went well, and now her business supplies arrangements for the Oscars, the Cannes Film Festival, and several top London hotels. Ellis is not the only one to have been influenced by the night. A few years ago, I asked people whether they had ever experienced a dream that had changed their life, and if so, to describe what had happened. Hundreds of people sent in their life-changing dreams. One woman described how she'd been overweight, but in her dreams saw a new her that regularly went to the gym and stayed away from the dessert trolley. Impressed with this imaginary slimline version of herself, the woman decided to adopt a much more healthy lifestyle and lost a large amount of weight. In another instance, a man described how he had had a dream in which he was being a much better father to his children. In the dream, he had decided to work fewer hours in the office and spend more time at home. As a result, both the man and his family were much happier. The man woke up, went to work, and negotiated a part-time position. Both dementia research and these type of experiences suggest that your nocturnal therapist doesn't just help identify your worries and concerns, but can also help you to see new and innovative solutions to your problems. Harvard sleep expert Deirdre Barrett decided to take the idea one step further by seeing whether it was possible to persuade people's nocturnal therapist to tackle a specific real-world problem. Barrett assembled a group of volunteers who were facing a major life decision, such as a career change or relationship issue. She then asked them to jot down the problem before they went to sleep. Each morning, the volunteers were asked to make a note of whether their dreams helped them solve the issue. About 50% of the volunteers dreamt about their problem, with a notable 70% of those finding a solution in their dream. In one instance, a young woman named Mary had been offered a place on both clinical psychology and industrial psychology courses, and couldn't decide which to choose. In her dream, Mary saw herself flying over a map of America. The pilot announced that the plane had engine trouble and needed to land. Mary suggested landing in Massachusetts, but the pilot said that it was very dangerous, and that the plane needed to head further west. Mary woke up and thought about the dream. The clinical psychology course was based in her home state of Massachusetts, whereas the industrial course was in California. Mary realized that deep down, she didn't want to stay so close to home, and that moving away was the right decision. In another example, a young man named Frank was trying to decide whether he should rejoin his local softball team. Frank was afraid that the practice sessions would distract him from his studies, and as a compromise had considered just going to watch the games as a spectator. During the study, Frank repeatedly dreamt about standing around some tents that didn't go all the way to the ground and awkwardly staring at what was going on inside each of the tents. These dreams made Frank feel very uncomfortable and reminded him of the phrase, a watcher rather than a doer. This phrase had very negative connotations for Frank, and as a result he decided that he wouldn't be happy simply observing the softball games. A week after the study, Frank signed up for the team. This research shows that it is possible to ask your nocturnal therapist to focus their attention on a specific problem. Then, throughout the night, they look at the issue from a variety of perspectives, and, all being well, you see the fruits of their labor in a dream. This simple procedure can radically improve people's lives. In fact, it can even change the world. Finding your dream solution. Do you want to use your dreams to help solve a problem? Try the following technique. Note, this exercise is designed to illustrate a technique used by health professionals. If you believe that you or your child have a psychological problem, please consult a professional. Place a pen, a pad of paper, and a torch on a table next to your bed. Briefly jot down your problem on the paper before you go to bed. If possible, try to find some objects that are connected to the problem and place them on the table. For example, if you are trying to tackle a problem at work, you might want to place a folder containing relevant documents on the table. If you are trying to find your way through a difficult relationship, consider placing your wedding ring there. When you are tucked up in bed, imagine yourself dreaming about the problem, waking up and writing a solution on your notepad. Just as you are falling asleep, mentally tell yourself that you want to dream about the problem and find some possible solutions. If you wake from a dream during the night, make a quick note of the main gist of the dream on your pad. Invite more dreams and go back to sleep. When you wake up in the morning, lie quietly for a few minutes before you get out of bed. Can you remember any of your dreams? If so, note down the main themes and images that went through your head. After a week or so, review your dreams. What are the main themes and images to emerge? Did any dream seem especially striking and helpful? The Brownies. Born in Edinburgh in 1850, Robert Louis Stevenson wrote several highly acclaimed books, including Treasure Island, The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and Kidnapped. Stevenson was fascinated by sleep and dreaming throughout the whole of his life. As a child, the great novelist frequently experienced night terrors, and as a young man he would enjoy vivid dreams involving fantastical adventures in faraway places. As time went by, Stevenson realized that he often experienced complete stories throughout the night, and was even able to return to the same story on successive nights and witness different endings. Eventually, he managed to train himself to remember his dreams, and used them as a basis for several of his plots. Later in life, Stevenson described this process in an extraordinary essay entitled A Chapter on Dreams. He noted that dreams were like a small theatre of the brain which we keep brightly lighted all night long. His own nocturnal theatre was populated by a cast of little people that he referred to as his brownies. As time went by, Stevenson's imaginary cast started to produce plays that acted as the basis for many of his novels. Perhaps the most famous instance of this brownie-based brainstorming provided the inspiration for his most celebrated story, The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Stevenson had spent several days trying to find a suitable plot for his new novel, and eventually decided to call on the help of his beloved brownies. After a few hours asleep, he drifted into a dream and found himself watching a scene in which a good man was being pursued for some type of crime. In a panic, the character ingested a kind of powder or potion and transformed into the personification of evil. At that moment, Stevenson screamed out in his sleep and his wife woke him up. The great novelist was less than delighted, claiming that he was dreaming of a fine bogey tale and had now quite literally lost the plot. However, despite being unexpectedly pulled away from the brownie's performance, Stevenson was able to complete his most famous work of fiction in just a few days. This inspirational use of dreaming eventually became an essential part of Stevenson's work, with the great writer noting, "When I lay down to prepare myself for sleep, I no longer seek amusement, but printable and profitable tales." Towards the end of his essay, Stevenson explains that he doesn't fully understand this mysterious process. "Who are they then, my brownies who do one half my work for me while I'm fast asleep?" But says that he had noticed that it often takes a threatening letter from his bank to kickstart the brownies into action. Another great Scottish writer, Sir Walter Scott, also relied on a similar process and once noted, "When I have got over any knotty difficulty in a story, it was always when I first opened my eyes that the desired ideas thronged upon me. This is so much the case that when I am at a loss, I say to myself, 'Never mind, we shall have it at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning.'" Stevenson and Scott are far from the only writers to have found inspiration in their dreams. In 1797, for instance, Samuel Taylor Coleridge fell asleep one afternoon and dreamt over 200 lines of a new poem. When Coleridge woke, he furiously scribbled down the lines but was interrupted by a visitor. After the visitor had left, Coleridge was unable to remember the last lines he had composed during his sleep, with the consequence that his best-known poem, Kubla Khan, remained unfinished. More recently, horror writer Stephen King has described how the plots for many of his books have come to him in his dreams. For example, the genesis of his best-selling book, Misery. In the early 1980s, King fell asleep while on a flight and dreamt about an author who was held captive by a psychotic fan. King woke up and scribbled down some notes on an airline napkin. The following night, he started to write his now classic novel. Other works of fiction inspired by dreams include Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre, and Stephanie Meyer's Twilight trilogy. Evidence that, in my opinion, even the brownies have off days. Such dreamlike inspiration is not limited to writers. In fact, many musicians have created their best work while sound asleep. For instance, the 18th century Italian Baroque composer Giuseppe Tartini dreamt that he had sold his soul to the devil, woke up, and produced his now famous Devil's Trill Sonata. Several centuries later, the same dreamlike inspiration helped Paul McCartney to create one of the Beatles' most famous songs. In May 1965, McCartney was staying with his mother in London. One morning he woke up with the tune to Yesterday fully formed in his mind, but was convinced that he couldn't have composed it in his sleep. After playing it to several colleagues, McCartney slowly realized that it was his own creation and started to work on some lyrics. After trying with various options, McCartney settled on lyrics that referred to the death of his father and created his classic song. Similarly, many athletes have changed the face of sport in their dreams. The world-famous golfer Jack Nicklaus had a dream in which he was holding his club in a different type of grip. The following day, Nicklaus tried out the new grip for real and suddenly experienced a run of success. Heavyweight boxing champion Floyd Patterson would create new types of punches in his dreams and then try them out for real in the ring. And the world-class acrobat Tito Jaona described how she would dream about new moves and routines when she was sound asleep and then recreate them the following day. The same remarkable nocturnal process has resulted in several scientific and technological discoveries that have changed the course of history. Chemist Dmitry Mendeleev created the modern-day periodic table after a dream in which he imagined the elements being related to one another in the same way that musical notes are part of a larger structure. Similarly, chemist August Kekulé figured out the structure of the chemical compound benzene after dreaming about a snake biting its own tail and realizing that the elusive compound was composed of a ring of carbon atoms. At the turn of the last century, the Indian mathematical genius Srinivasa Ramanujan teamed up with Cambridge scholar Godfrey Hardy and made a series of breakthroughs in number theory. Ramanujan was often inspired by his dreams, claiming that the Hindu goddess Namagiri would frequently appear to him during the night and present him with formulae. Around the same time, the German pharmacologist Otto Loewi dreamt about how to carry out an experiment that would reveal how nervous impulses travelled around the body. Loewi's experiment formed the basis for work that eventually led to him receiving a Nobel Prize and being labelled the father of neuroscience. Dreams have also played a key role in several inventions. In the 1840s, Elias Howe created the first sewing machine after dreaming about spears with holes near their tips, and realizing that placing a hole at the tip of the needle would prevent the thread from catching after it went through cloth. More recently, Harvard electrical engineer Paul Horovitz has described how he regularly relied on his dreams when he was trying to design radio telescopes. In his dreams, Horovitz would watch a man working on the same problem that he himself faced in real life. Often the mythical man in Horovitz's dream would come up with a solution. Given the inspirational role that dreams have played in the arts and science, it is perhaps no surprise that the French symbolist poet Saint-Paul Roux used to hang a sign on his bedroom door proclaiming poet at work. And author John Steinbeck attributed dream-based breakthroughs to the Committee of Sleep. In this lesson, we have uncovered the surprising scientific truth about dreaming. Each night, your dreams act like a nocturnal therapist who helps you identify concerns in your waking life and tries to find innovative solutions to your problems. Over the years, these therapists have worked away night after night, helping millions of people and inspiring countless writers, musicians, and scientists. Perhaps the most exciting aspect of the research shows that it's possible to make the most of your nocturnal therapist by learning a few simple dream-based techniques. Dreams are far from the meaningless froth on the beer of sleep. Note, Sigmund Freud first used the term dreams as froth, Traume sind Schaume, to describe theories suggesting that dreams are essentially meaningless. In fact, they have the power to improve your life and even change the world. The Secret Science of the Bedtime Story. Parents have read bedtime stories to their children for generations. These stories allow parents to spend time with their children, help promote their language skills, and gently help them fall asleep. But could they also serve another vitally important purpose? During dreaming, your unconscious mind works through any problems that you are facing in your life, and, like a skilled therapist, tries to soften the emotional impact of these issues and find novel solutions. The bedtime stories that we tell our children seem perfectly designed to complement this process. We read these stories to children just as they are falling asleep, and many of the classic tales contain important life lessons that help them cope with everyday stresses and concerns. The Boy Who Cried Wolf underlines the importance of not telling lies. The Ugly Duckling encourages children not to judge people by their looks. And The Three Little Pigs is all about the power of perseverance. Could it be that the structure and timing of bedtime stories have evolved to give young minds more pleasant and productive dreams? And if this is the case, is it possible to create even more effective stories that are explicitly designed to reflect the psychological principles that underlie a happy, productive, and resilient life? To find out, I teamed up with educator and writer Jenny Hembleton to create the world's first science-based bedtime story. We decided to focus on an important aspect of resilience that helps give people hope when bad things happen to them. The idea forms the basis of a well-known Zen parable concerning a wise farmer. The parable starts with the farmer waking up one morning and discovering that his best horse has run away. The farmer's neighbors hear the news and say, "What bad luck!" However, the wise farmer simply replies, "Maybe." That evening, the farmer's horse comes back and brings a wild horse with it. Upon hearing this news, the farmer's neighbors exclaim, "What wonderful luck!" And again, the farmer replies, "Maybe." The next morning, the farmer's son climbs on the untamed horse, is thrown off, and breaks his leg. The farmer's neighbors see this and say, "What bad luck!" Again, the farmer replies, "Maybe." Finally, that evening, some military officers arrive at the village to draft the young men into the army, but have to leave the farmer's son because of his broken leg. As a result, the neighbors congratulate the farmer on his amazing good luck. This simple parable illustrates the idea that seemingly negative events can turn out to be surprisingly positive in the long run. And so it's important not to feel too downhearted when bad things happen. We took this simple notion as our starting point and created a story that children would understand, identify with, and enjoy. The resulting story is called Donald and the Elephant at School, and suitable for children aged 4 to 6, and can be found at the end of the book. In the story, a young boy called Donald finds a friendly elephant on the way to school. Donald befriends the elephant and takes him into classes. Unfortunately, things do not start well. The elephant throws paint around, eats everyone's food, and ruins a music lesson. Donald thinks that finding the elephant was a disaster, but then the elephant saves the day during a school trip. And Donald realizes that sometimes everything works out for the best. The language in the story has been carefully chosen to maximize the likelihood of key elements influencing a child's dreams. Psychologists have long known that words that are easy to imagine, such as chair and house, are also much easier to remember than those that do not instantly conjure up a mental image, such as peace and justice. During this work, researchers have presented people with thousands of words and asked them to rate how easy it is to imagine each word. When we wrote Donald and the Elephant at School, we used these lists to identify words that are extremely easy to imagine, such as elephant, paint, and water, and built the story around these words. In addition, other research has shown that strange and unusual combinations of images, such as a large mouse chasing a small cat, are more memorable than mundane combinations, such as a large cat chasing a small mouse. So we designed the story to incorporate a series of unusual scenes, such as an elephant throwing paint around, jumping in a swimming pool, and playing a musical instrument. Finally, the story ends with Donald wondering whether the elephant will come back to school the next day, but never seeing him again. This final line is designed to provoke a sense of curiosity, encourage children to think about where the elephant went and what happened next, and so to increase the likelihood of the story affecting their dreams. We have also included a few simple comments for parents to make after the story in order to help cement its meaning in place. If you have children, read the story to them at bedtime. Then, the following morning, ask them to describe any dreams that they had during the night and see whether the positive theme of the story has had a beneficial effect on their sleeping mind. The science of sleep has provided a remarkable insight into the importance of bedtime stories. Armed with this new perspective, I believe that it's possible to create stories that boost children's psychological health during the night, and so help ensure that everyone really does live happily ever after. Assignment. Experimenting with your eyes and arms. Before we begin our final night school lesson, I'd like you to carry out two simple experiments involving your eyes and arms. The eyes experiment. For this experiment, you will need ready access to either a friend or a camera. Let's start off by assuming you have a friend around. Ask them to stand in front of you. No, not that close. About 2 feet away, that's better. Next, keep your head facing forwards, and then roll your eyes up towards the ceiling as far as they will go. All being well, you will be looking a few feet above your friend's head. Now keep looking up, and try to close your eyelids. When you do this, you might be tempted to lower your eyes. Fight the temptation. Finally, ask your friend to quickly look at the amount of white showing between the top of your lower eyelid and the base of your cornea, and then score the observation as follows. No white below the iris, 0. A small amount of white, score 1. A third white, score 2. Two-thirds white, score 3. Completely white, score 4. The experiment should only take a moment, and please do not continue with it if you experience any discomfort. If your friend is not around, simply hold a camera in front of your face, carry out the procedure described, and take a snapshot. You can then see where you sit on the scale by looking at the resulting photograph. Make a note of your score. The arms experiment. As you might imagine, this experiment involves your arms. Hold out both of your arms directly in front of you, ensuring that they are parallel to the floor, and that your two hands are level with one another. To the uninformed observer, it will appear as if you are mid-sleepwalk. In a few minutes, I'm going to ask you to close your eyes for about 30 seconds. When you do, I want you to imagine that there is a helium-filled balloon attached to the fingers of your right hand and a pile of heavy books attached to your left hand. The helium balloon will be pulling your right hand high into the air, and the books will be pulling your left hand towards the ground. Do not consciously move your hands, but try to imagine the balloon causing your right hand to drift upwards and the weight of the books dragging your left hand downwards. After around 30 seconds or so, open your eyes and look at the positions of your hands. Okay, away you go. Thanks. You can put your arms down now. Please use the following scale to convert the final position of your hands into a number between 0 and 4. If your left hand was higher than your right hand, stop messing around and repeat the test. Score 0 if your right and left hands are perfectly level. Score 1 if your right hand is less than an inch above your left hand. Score 2 if your right hand is between about 1 and 3 inches above your left hand. Score 3 if your right hand is between 3 and 6 inches above your left hand. Score 4 if your right hand is more than 6 inches above your left hand. Note your score. Finally, please add up your scores from the two experiments and make a note of your total score. Many thanks. When I first started working at the University of Hertfordshire, I had an office on the top floor of the psychology department. In addition to all of the furniture that you would usually expect to find in a university office, the room housed a large, black, reclining chair. I soon discovered that the chair was extremely comfortable, and from time to time would use it to take a quick nap. At the time, I had no idea that over the years the chair had played host to thousands of similarly sleepy people. The university's psychology department was founded in the early 1970s by an eccentric academic named Tony Gibson. Gibson led a colourful life that included playing a key role in the British anarchist movement, spending some of the Second World War in prison as an unregistered conscientious objector, and appearing as the Brill Cream Boy in a series of national hair gel advertisements. I never had the pleasure of meeting Gibson, but by all accounts he tended to be both abrupt and outspoken, with a colleague once noting, "I wish there were more people like Tony, but not too many." Gibson carried out several groundbreaking studies into hypnosis, with much of his work taking place in the big black chair that eventually found its way into my office. Over the years, Gibson investigated various fascinating topics, including the relationship between hypnosis and dreaming. Many people think that hypnosis is a form of sleep. In fact, nothing could be further from the truth. When people are hypnotized, they can usually hear perfectly well and have no problem responding to a hypnotist's detailed suggestions. In contrast, when people are asleep, they are much more isolated from the outside world and can rarely carry out complex behaviors. For these reasons, most psychologists see the hypnotic state as closer to being awake than asleep. But does that mean there is no relationship between hypnosis and dreaming? Both the eye-rolling and arm-raising experiments are reliable tests of how susceptible you are to being hypnotized. The higher your final score, the more easily you can be hypnotized, with a score of 6 or more indicating that you are highly hypnotizable, suggesting that at some point in your life you will find yourself on stage tucking into a tasty onion. Gibson found several major differences in the dreams of people who are and aren't especially susceptible to hypnosis. Highly hypnotizable people experience dreams that are especially vivid, colorful, pleasant, bizarre, and exciting. In addition, they are more likely to use their dreams as a source of creative inspiration and find meaning in them. Given that this is the case, it perhaps isn't surprising that they also tend to remember more of their dreams and believe that they contain paranormal clues about future events. So the next time you want to find out what really goes through someone's mind at night, ask them to roll their eyes and raise their arms. Gibson also discovered that highly hypnotizable people are often able to control their dreams and so experience their perfect nocturnal fantasies. However, the good news is that you don't have to be an extreme arm raiser in order to enjoy this wonderful experience. For the past 100 years, sleep scientists have developed several techniques to help everyone take control of your dreams. Best of all, we will be exploring these techniques in our final night school lesson. Lesson 8. Sweet Dreams, where we find out how to control your dreams, banish nightmares, and have a lucid dream. Welcome to your final lesson at night school. In the previous 7 lessons, we have traveled deep into the night and discovered how to radically improve your sleep and use your dreams to change your life. In this final lesson, we're going to take a close look at perhaps the strangest aspect of sleep science. In the science fiction film Inception, a character named Dominic Cobb is a dream architect who enters sleepers' subconscious minds and manipulates their dreams. Inception proved to be one of the highest-grossing films of all time, and the idea of dream control has caught the public imagination. It's easy to see why. After all, controlling your dreaming mind would allow you to experience any fantasy you desire, from spending quality time with your favorite celebrity to staging a thrilling bank heist, flying through space or lying on a sun-kissed beach, your imagination would be your only limit. For more than a century, sleep scientists have experimented with many different ways of trying to control dreams. Some of these techniques proved to be highly effective, and others were a complete failure. In this lesson, we are going to explore these ideas and sort the pseudoscientific chaff from the evidence-based wheat. Along the way, we are going to discover how to induce a lucid dream, find out the results from the world's largest dream control experiment, and learn how to banish nightmares. We begin our journey by meeting a man who has devoted his life to living the dream. On Becoming Lucid. As a child, Stephen LaBerge enjoyed going to the cinema each week and watching his matinee idols act out the latest installment of a thrilling adventure. One night he had an exciting dream about being an underwater pirate, and inspired by his heroes of the silver screen, wondered whether he would be able to persuade his sleeping brain to return to his imaginary adventure the following night. LaBerge found it surprisingly easy to re-enter the dream and spent the next few weeks repeatedly returning to his aquatic fantasy. During these dreams, LaBerge gradually became aware that he was able to hold his breath while underwater for a surprisingly long period of time. And this simple realization eventually resulted in him feeling as if he were awake during his pirate adventures. LaBerge had experienced a strange phenomenon that sleep scientists now refer to as lucid dreaming. During these fascinating episodes, people are aware that they are dreaming, and on a good night can even take control of their fantasy world. LaBerge's brief spell as an underwater pirate kicked off a lifelong interest in lucid dreaming. In the late 1970s, he decided to explore the topic in a more systematic way, and enrolled for a doctorate at Stanford University. At the time, many sleep scientists were somewhat skeptical about the existence of the phenomenon, arguing that it was impossible for the sleeping mind to become conscious or to take control of a dream. If these odd experiences were happening at all, argued the skeptics, then they must be occurring during micro-awakenings rather than during dreaming. LaBerge set out to prove the skeptics wrong. He decided to wire himself up to an EEG machine, fall asleep, have a lucid dream, and then analyze his brainwaves to discover whether he had been in REM. There was, however, one small problem with his plan. In order to know which part of the EEG data to examine, he needed to be able to indicate when he was having a lucid dream. Unfortunately, LaBerge was well aware that his body would be almost completely paralyzed when he was dreaming, and so making any kind of signal was going to be a tad tricky. After much head-scratching, he hit on a clever idea. Research had shown that during a dream, men's penises and eyes remained active, and so he reasoned that it might be possible to use one of these two moving parts to send a sign. Thankfully, he opted for trying to move his eyes. In January 1978, LaBerge conducted the first in a series of now classic experiments. He connected several EEG sensors to his head, climbed into bed, and settled down for the night. After a few hours of sleep, he opened his eyes and looked around the room. Everything appeared fine except that he was unable to feel or hear anything. Realizing that he was probably having a lucid dream, he took command of his imaginary world and slowly waved his hand in front of his face. He then tried to track his imaginary hand by actually moving his eyes from side to side. A few seconds later, the experience faded and he woke up. When LaBerge examined his EEG data, he was thrilled to see that the sensors had detected several very large eye movements. As a result, he was able to pinpoint the exact moment that he had been having a lucid dream. He looked at his brain activity from this part of the night and was delighted to discover that his lucid dream had indeed taken place during REM. Laberger had proven the skeptics wrong. Laberger has spent much of his subsequent career developing various psychological techniques that help people to have lucid dreams, including imagining their perfect dream before they fall asleep, and getting into the habit of regularly conducting various reality tests to discover if they are in a lucid dream or not. He has also created several gadgets to help would-be lucid dreamers, including a high-tech blindfold that monitors their eye movements throughout the night and that activates several bright lights in its center whenever it detects a significant amount of eye movement. And all being well, the person sees these lights in their dream, and this helps them become aware that they are dreaming. These techniques have allowed thousands of people across the world to create their perfect dream. Perhaps predictably, many of them have used the opportunity to engage in the ultimate form of safe sex. Curious about this somewhat seedy side of the night, Laberger once invited an experienced female lucid dreamer to his laboratory and monitored her brain activity, eye movements, and vaginal activity. The volunteer was asked to try to have a sexy lucid dream and then move her eyes in a predetermined way when she reached orgasm. During the night, the woman's eye movements suggested that she was having the best of times for one 15-second period. Throughout this time, her vaginal activity was at a maximum, suggesting that lucid dreams do indeed have the power to stimulate the genitalia and create genuine sexual experiences. When they are not exploring people's dream orgasms, researchers have delved deep into the strange science of lucid dreaming and examined whether this weird phenomenon can be used to help solve more down-to-earth problems. A Beginner's Guide to Lucidity. Stephen Laberge and several other sleep scientists have developed a variety of psychological techniques to help you gain conscious control of your dreams. In 2012, Tadas Stumbries from Heidelberg University reviewed these techniques to help determine which had the highest success rate. Some of them are carried out during the day, while others are intended for the night. Here is a brief summary of the most effective procedures. Feel free to mix and match whichever ones seem to work for you. During the day, making time. Look at your watch between 5 and 10 times each day and check that you can see the numerals properly each time. After a week or so, this strange watch-looking procedure will become a habit, and you will start to do it in your dreams. During a dream, you will struggle to read the numerals on your watch dial, and this will help you to become lucid. Visualize your perfect lucid dream. Find a few minutes each day to lie down, close your eyes, and imagine how it would feel to have a lucid dream. Visualize who you would most like to meet in your dream and what you would love to happen. Enjoy the experience and allow your imagination to create your wildest fantasy. When you go to bed, set your intention. Place a pen and pad on your bedside table. Just before you go to bed, tell yourself that you want to wake up towards the end of a dream and be able to remember what thoughts and images were going through your head. If you are successful, write down a brief description of your dream. Then, as you drift back to sleep, imagine yourself returning to the dream but becoming lucid. Visualize yourself back in the same scenario but doing something that will reveal that you are in a dream. There are certain experiences that your brain struggles to produce during a lucid dream, perhaps because they require too much thinking power, or because you have never experienced them in real life. And so you might, for example, look in a mirror. Lucid dreamers tend to see a blurred reflection. Levitate off the ground, turn on the lights. In a lucid dream, it isn't possible to alter the illumination levels, or check the numerals on your watch. Raise the alarm. Set your alarm clock to wake you up about an hour before you normally get out of bed. When you wake up, spend the next 30 minutes reading a book, working on a jigsaw puzzle, or quietly writing about the thoughts that are going through your head. Now get back to sleep. This technique, known as sleep interruption, increases the likelihood of a lucid dream about 20-fold. When you have a lucid dream, take it easy. Many first-time lucid dreamers become very excited once they're aware that they are dreaming, and this feeling of excitement terminates the dream. Try to stay relaxed and calm. Go for a spin. If you think that the lucid dream is about to end, then try imagining rubbing your hands together or spinning around like a top. According to experienced lucid dreamers, this sense of movement will help you remain in the dream. Finally, if all these techniques fail, try playing computer games. Research shows that those who regularly play first-person games have more lucid dreams than non-gamers. Unicycling, snowboarding, and skateboarding. Research into lucid dreaming has revealed that around 50% of adults have had this strange experience at least once in their lives, and that 1 in 5 people experience it on a monthly basis. Unlike many other psychological phenomena, there is no relationship between the frequency of lucid dreaming and a person's age, sex, or personality. By asking lucid dreamers to move their eyes whenever the experience started and stopped, researchers were also able to discover that most lucid dreams last about 2 minutes and tend to take place early in the morning. Perhaps most intriguing of all, scientists have uncovered several surprising differences between lucid dreams and the more run-of-the-mill experiences that mere mortals have on a nightly basis. For example, the curious work on dream characters. As we discovered in Lesson 7, most dreams are populated by the dreamer's friends, family members, and work colleagues. In contrast, lucid dreams frequently feature complete strangers. Discovering more about these mysterious characters isn't easy, in part because lucid dreamers often report that staring at these strangers causes them to cover their face, turn off the lights, and wear a hood in future dreams. However, some lucid dreamers have slowly gained the trust of these shy, imaginary individuals, and eventually persuaded them to take part in several tests. In the late 1980s, a pioneering German sleep scientist named Paul Tholey told a group of lucid dreamers to ask their dream characters to make a drawing and name a word that wasn't known to the dreamer. Even though the lucid dreamers were unaware of each other's reports, remarkably similar results emerged. The dream characters were perfectly capable of making quite impressive drawings, with one of them even showing off by creating a strange-looking sketch and then turning it upside down to reveal that it was a self-portrait. Even more amazingly, some of the characters were also able to name a word that was not known to the lucid dreamer. For example, one male lucid dreamer bumped into an imaginary female friend and asked her to name a foreign word that he was unfamiliar with. The woman remarked, "Orlog," and went on to explain that the word described their relationship. In the morning, the lucid dreamer looked up the word and discovered that it was Dutch for quarrel. However, other work suggests that the dream characters don't have much of a head for numbers. In several studies, researchers have asked lucid dreamers to set their dream characters increasingly difficult mathematical problems. This has proved a tad tricky because many of the dream characters were reluctant to participate. In one instance, for example, a lucid dreamer asked one imaginary man if he would mind doing some arithmetic problems. The man agreed, and so the lucid dreamer asked him to calculate 4 times 4. The man confidently replied 16 and requested a harder problem. The lucid dreamer decided to up the ante by asking him to calculate 21 times 21. Suddenly the man waved goodbye and promptly disappeared. However, several lucid dreamers have managed to persuade their dream characters to sit a series of increasingly difficult tests. The results revealed that the characters were fine with very simple sums, but struggled when the answer was greater than 20. The research also suggests that the type of maths-based stereotypes that exist in the real world also hold true in lucid dreams, with male dream characters exhibiting better mathematical skills than their imaginary female counterparts. Further work into lucid dreaming has examined whether the technique can help improve people's lives. In some studies, researchers have asked experienced lucid dreamers to practice a physical skill during their dreams, and then assess the effect of these nocturnal fantasies on the dreamer's ability to perform these skills in the real world. Once again, much of this work was carried out by Paul Tholey. As well as being a highly respected academic, Tholey was also a top-notch lucid dreamer, a skateboarder, snowboard fanatic, and cyclist. He decided to experiment on himself and discover whether lucid dreaming could help him hone his skills. After much trial and error, Tholey claimed that his nocturnal fantasies had helped him to balance blindfolded on a unicycle, snowboard without bindings, and perform a handstand on a skateboard. Although his claims were greeted with more than a pinch of skepticism from many mainstream scientists, recent research suggests that the skateboarding academic was onto something. In 2010, Daniel Erlacher, now at the University of Bern in Switzerland, decided to carry out the first laboratory-based experiment to examine whether lucid dreamers can enhance a physical skill. Erlacher asked a group of lucid dreamers to practice throwing a coin into a cup in their dreams, and then tested their real-life coin-throwing skills the next morning. As predicted by Tholey's experiences with unicycles and skateboards, the lucid dreamers who reported being able to practice when they were sound asleep were better at the task. On the upside, all of this imaginary exercise does not make people feel tired when they wake up. On the downside, learning to become conscious during a dream is very tricky, and some people never manage it. Luckily, for more than a century, a handful of researchers have experimented with a much easier way of taking control of the night. Their story starts with one of the very first sleep scientists. Sweet dreams are made of cheese. In Charles Dickens's A Christmas Carol, Ebenezer Scrooge tries to convince himself that the ghost of Jacob Marley is nothing more than a crumb of undigested cheese, and famously declares that there's more of the gravy than of grave about you. This passage helped give rise to the popular myth that eating cheese affects your dreams. But is there any truth behind Scrooge's panicked utterances? To find out, in 2005, the British Cheese Board asked 200 volunteers to spend a week eating a small piece of cheese before going to sleep, and then report their dreams. This fun experiment disproved the notion that cheese gives you nightmares, with the majority of volunteers enjoying a pleasant night. Interestingly, the British Cheese Board also announced that the type of cheese consumed seemed to affect the volunteers' dreams. Stilton caused bizarre dreams, with one Stilton eater dreaming about soldiers fighting each other with kittens instead of guns. Cheddar eaters dream about celebrities. Red Leicester causes people to dream about their past. And one Brie eater dreamt about having a drunken conversation with his dog. Alternatively, if you want to have an erotic dream, bury your face in the pillow. Psychologist Calvin Kai-Ching Yu from Hong Kong Shuyan University has examined the relationship between